Today, I've got a very interesting guest that's written a very interesting book on the subject of addiction. Now, if I were to exclude my book from the discussion, I could easily say that in the last 40 years of reading things about addiction, that this is the best book that I've ever read. So therefore, if you have an addictive behavior, if you have a relative with an addictive behavior, if you have a friend or an associate, this is the book to get. You've got to get Donna Marks's book, Exit the Maze. Okay, so let me tell you what hooked me. I get lots of requests to be on this show from a lot of different places. And I saw this media blip, and it said how COVID-19 is ramping up addiction. So I started reading. It says, we've all been told to stay at home to avoid spreading the coronavirus, but psychotherapist and addiction counselor Donna Marks warns that what we do in that alone time may be deadlier than the virus. She says, the current coronavirus crisis is ramping up addiction, and that the stress of unemployment, the fears of death, and the closed down recovery meetings significantly increase addiction relapse. Dr. Marks says that Americans have significantly upped their food and alcohol consumption during this period of forced isolation. And we're going to hear why addiction is far more deadly than the current virus and, in fact, increases the lethality rate. And she's going to discuss the role of fear in addiction, share tips and strategies to make healthy, sober choices, and ways to support a loved one struggling with addiction during this difficult time. Donna is well educated and credentialed to do this work. And she believes, as I do, that the current models for diagnosis, treatment of addiction have failed. Her mission is to help save at least 10 million lives by 2030 through education and prevention. She has been an author, a consultant, an educator, a public speaker, licensed psychotherapist, and addiction counselor, and has been in practice, private practice, for over 30 years. She developed a chemical dependency treatment program at Palm Beach Community College that has subsequently grown into a four-year degree program. In 1989, she earned her doctorate degree in adult education and then became a certified addiction professional and many other certifications also. But the thing about Donna is that she's the first one that's written a book that really got it. I've been telling people for close to 40-something years that unless you have a spiritually-based treatment program, you're barking up the wrong tree. You're not going to get anywhere with treating addiction. And if you look around in society today, they don't have that. And so Donna has that, I have that, and now we're going to have a great program. How are you doing, Donna?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic, and thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Well, you deserve it. And I really believe that of all the books that I have recommended, that this is the most important book that I have recommended, other than my own, to deal with this whole problem of addiction, which is the worst health crisis in the world. And why is that? Because of the almost 8 billion people in the world, the vast majority of them, if they haven't already gotten the secret, are suffering from some behavior of addiction. And I'll open it up to say that my definition of addiction is, if you have a behavior that you find out is hurting you in some respect, physically, mentally, spiritually, whatever, or is hurting someone that you love, and you can't stop it, regardless of the reason that you give, you're addicted to that behavior. And we can talk about that later, but that allows us to say that most people in the world are addicted. And you and I know the fallout from this disease, so let's get on with it. You titled your book, Exit the Maze. That sounds like a rat in a maze wanting to get out.
Right.
What?
Right.
So why did you choose this title, you know?
Well, because a maze is something that, you know, we all remember those little puzzles, but I also had the, you know, psychology experiments in college of putting the, you know, the rat in the maze and teaching him how to get out or not get out. And a maze is something that has quarters, and you can get lost in there. And the more you try to get out, the further deep into the maze you go. And that's why I refer to it as a maze, because an addiction is like that. You know, you keep going up and down, trying this and that, switching from one addiction to another, and you can't get out. You just go in deeper and deeper and deeper.
Now, your subtitle, which was the thing that hooked me to want to talk to you and to share your mission with the world, is One Addiction, One Cause, One Cure. And I believe that so thoroughly that I wanted to bring this information to all the people on the planet that want to hear it. So why don't we briefly get into your reasoning on these three things. Why did you say One Addiction?
Well, over the years of working in the field and having it my own part ownership in an outpatient treatment center, working with addiction and being born into it and everything else, I found out what does and doesn't work. And what happens is often someone will have an addiction, like, say, drug addiction, and they'll go to treatment. And then they get out of treatment, and they switch over to alcohol. You know, I've never had a problem with alcohol. Or they go to treatment for pills, and, you know, I've never had a problem with pot. And or they, you know, go to treatment for smoking, and then they start eating. So one of the things I realized is, oh, my goodness, these people aren't really getting well. And I did it myself. I switched from, I quit smoking and quit drinking, and then marathon running, and, you know, work, and it just keeps moving around. It's like the game of whack-a-mole, you know, or those little ducks at the circus, you keep, at the fair, you keep shooting them down, another one pops up. So I said there's one addiction, because the one addiction, in my opinion, is this void deep inside. You know, this feeling that I'm not okay, something's missing, and I call that void the invisible hole. And from that place, it's always looking for the next quick fix. It's got an antenna that's trying to plug into whatever will relieve that horrible, empty feeling inside. So that's why I say there's only one addiction.
Well, okay, so...
And it's that emptiness inside.
We'll stop with that first thing. And I want to say that in my work, I find this... symptom as the void. You know, you and I may have the same take on the whole deal. We may use a word, but it's the same thing. And there's over 30 different addiction behaviors that I've identified. And one addiction is no better or worse than another when they're all equal.
Right.
And so that if you were a negative thinker, that wouldn't be any better or worse than a drug abuser. People ask me, well, you're an addictionologist. That means you treat drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. And I say, well, you know, I do that, but to get the idea of the scope of the thing, that's way down the list on the common addiction problem behaviors today. I think that number one is screen addiction and all the aspects of being addicted to your screens. Uh-huh. I think the second one may be overeating. But regardless of how they line up, in terms of the number of people that are addicted to that behavior, they're not right at the top. But we treat all addictions because they come from the same place, and they can be treated the same way spiritually, and they get the same results as one. And so, number one, I agree totally with you. Now, let's go on to the one cause. Tell me, what is the one cause in your view?
Well, one of the things I noticed in working with over 6,000 people is that without fail, every single person who had an addiction had some type of underlying pain. You know, some type of trauma happened, usually early on, not always, but usually. You know, it could have been something of subtle, like a child wasn't allowed to express their feelings, so they learned how to keep everything bottled up inside, and that started drilling that void. But it could have been, and usually is, something more severe, such as neglect, physical or sexual abuse. And that child starts feeling like something's wrong with them. They're not fitting in. They're not feeling self-love. They're not, they just feel different. And that void continues to grow and grow and grow to the point that the pain becomes so intense they have to medicate it with something. So, and I don't believe that addiction is genetic at all. I've never heard of a single study that says that the gene that dictates that you have to drink, smoke, use pornography, be on constant distraction. So it's always learned from either watching other people or through experimentation.
Okay, so my input to that is I have a different work group for that, and I believe there is one cause, and I believe it's low self-esteem. You don't value yourself or love yourself enough to escape from looking for some fix in the environment that's going to cure that problem. And so I think we're on the same page on that. And also I understand that having a low self-esteem generally comes from some kind of pain.
Right.
I don't adhere to the fact that any one particular thing can cause an addiction, but it's an accumulation of things that cause low self-esteem because, you know, all addictions, if you understand them, are going to hurt you. Some of them will kill you. And why would a person that valued themselves adequately want to suffer through their life or die? I can't get
Right. Well, a baby isn't born with a low self-esteem. That's learned. So to understand that to have a low self-esteem, I help people to get to what caused that low self-esteem so that they can reclaim their birthright as perfect and lovable and beautiful and whole.
Right. Okay, now.
And they can't do that if they're carrying that guilt and shame and wound around from childhood. They can't get there.
Exactly. Now, the third point is you and I say one cure. And my first book back many years ago was The Cure of Addiction. And the local authorities in addiction said, well, that's not right. You can't cure addiction. And I said, oh, yes, you can, but you have to cure it the right way. So what do you think about the one cure?
Well, if the one problem is low self-esteem, then the one cure would be for someone to feel so much love for themselves that the thought of doing anything abusive to their mind or body that would harm them or others is the farthest thing from their mind. So just like that new baby that comes into the world and gets their needs met and they grow up feeling like they're good about themselves and good about their relationships and good about life, people have to learn how to do that for themselves. So the cure is learning how to love yourself and how to connect spiritually. And love is spirituality. God is love. And so we have to have that deeper meaning and purpose and that deeper connection to ourselves. You know, I can't ever get sober for someone else. It has to be because I've decided that I'm worth it. And even if I don't think I am, I'm willing to think that love knows I'm worth it. God knows I'm worth it. And I work to get myself out of that hellhole of addiction into loving myself. And that sometimes people are like, well, what does that mean? And I literally have to teach them step by step to analyze all of their decisions and choices. Are they either loving or are they self-destructive?
Absolutely. Now, I did family practice for a long time, and if I were to go back and try to tell you what was the most common reason for somebody to walk in the door, the first would be anxiety or nervousness, or one of the variations of what anxiety means to a person. And the second would be depression. And so I made a list of all the symptoms of the disease of addiction that people told me that they had. And of those 20, anxiety and depression topped the list. But I was wondering what you think is a relationship between anxiety and addiction.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I don't believe there's such a thing as anxiety. I think that's a term that the psychiatrists and medicine has used. And again, then you're referring to addiction as a brain disorder or some chemical imbalance in the body. And we all know that since all addictions are learned and that gene isn't there to cause the brain disorder that demands I have to do all these things, then we can reframe this from the perspective that it's fear. You know, it's not anxiety, it's fear. You know, I'm conditioned to be afraid. I'm afraid that if I don't do this, then I'm going to feel terrible. I'm afraid that this is going to happen and it's going to be a catastrophe. I'm afraid my husband's having an affair. I'm afraid my kids are using drugs. I'm afraid of snakes out in the garden that I've never seen in my entire life, a snake in the garden, but I just know there's one in there somewhere. I'm afraid I'm not going to get the house clean today. I'm afraid there's not enough money. I'm afraid that I'm going to get the coronavirus. Fear, 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 fear. And so if we could stop and put the brakes on and go, wait, this is an anxiety. You know, I am having a chemical reaction in my body, but it's because of my thoughts that I'm attaching to one fear after the next. I'm turning on the news. It's ramping up all of those chemicals in my body, which are all fear-based. Now, that symptom that we have when we feel a threat is very important because it's that built-in survival thing called, you know, the fight or flight response. And our, as you know, as a physician, better than I do, but, you know, hormones and adrenaline are released to give us that sense of heightened awareness so we can better protect ourselves. But most of this addiction type of stuff and mental health anxiety is nothing more than fear. And the good news is if we claim it as fear, then we can do something about it. We don't have to take pills. We don't have to medicate it. We don't have to drink it away or drug it away or distract it. We can just say, this is fear, and I can manage the fear because I can learn how to walk through it and deal with it.
So, like you said, anxiety is a diagnosis that psychologists and psychiatrists put down on your chart so that they can get paid for the office visit.
Well, but, I'd rather you and MD say that than me. But yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
But the underlying cause of anxiety, or whatever that symptom means to people, is fear. And so we can't necessarily get rid of all the fear in our environment, just like this coronavirus. People are so afraid of it that they're going to die, that this, that, and the other is going to happen and everything, that they're plunged into these negative ways of thinking. But what we need to do and what you recommend and what I recommend is get rid of the fear. And so,
exactly.
or say, yes, I'm afraid, but in spite of that, I'm going to do what's best for me to live the healthiest life that I can, something like that.
Correct. You know, right now with the virus, I mean, are you sitting there and watching every possible negative scenario on TV? Because if you are, and you're not able to just go, oh, that's interesting, this is a TV show, then you're going to become more and more fearful as you watch it. But if you take the information and apply it to your real life, if you are at risk, for getting the virus and possibly dying. In other words, you have a compromised immune system of some sort because of your health. And by all means, the best thing is to stay home. But you don't have to stay home and be afraid. You can still go about your life. You don't have to get drunk. You don't have to get high. You don't have to, you know, be in a frenzy. You can just simply use this free time to catch up on old projects, read, develop new hobbies and interests, learn a foreign language, cook, get really involved with your family or your friends, even if it's on the phone, and have, you know, wonderful conversations. There's just so many opportunities right now to heal and to have better relationships. Instead, people are like panic-stricken and obsessed with talking nothing about politics and the coronavirus, and it's all coming to an end, da-da-da-da-da. And it's just robbing them of peace and joy and opportunity.
Absolutely. Now, I often have learned that if you want to get to the bottom of a problem, you follow the money.
And, right.
In our country, there are over 14,000 treatment centers, and they pull an annual revenue of over $35 billion. And $1 billion is $1,000 million. So you can see the amount of money that some people are getting proportionally to, you know, what their treatment centers are like to work on this problem. But the problem below that is that their therapy is not effective. Well over 50%, depending on who you talk to, maybe much higher than that, people relapse from a program, even if it costs them, let's say, $60,000 to do the program for 30 days. Now, I know your book is under $20, and so is mine. And I imagine that we would both say that the better way of spending $20 is to read the book, because you don't have $60,000 to spend if you're not going to get the best results, right?
That's correct. And it's a good start. And then if you apply what's in the book, which is to be able to, you know, get some help with dealing with the underlying cause and the pain and the triggers that cause someone to relapse, and then you get connected with a support system that is loving and caring supports your recovery, you have a very good chance. But just going to treatment, and you know, most of the people that own treatment centers now are businessmen. They're not actually like some of the earlier treatment centers that were started by people who were in recovery. And then they used the tools that they had to teach other people how to stay sober. And they really got into the nitty-gritty of, you know, you just don't use no matter what. And they had the tools there to do it. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the people that didn't stay sober back then didn't stay sober because they didn't deal with that underlying cause. You know, traditionally, recovery programs have been designed to not really delve into that pain that's underneath the addiction. In fact, they discourage you from doing that and just looking at your own role in situations, which is good, but I think it needs to be a combination of both. So the fact that so many business people own treatment centers today, they don't. It's all about the money. Yes, follow the money. And they'll take the same patient, you know, 5, 6, 7 times.
That's right.
And to me, that's just another addiction. Addicted to treatment. You're doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results.
Exactly. And, you know, probably the biggest, what is called a spiritual program, but not really, is the 12-step program, and started back in, I think, 1935 by two alcoholics. And the problem that I see with it, and I wrote a book some years ago about why it didn't work, is that they didn't recognize that you have to increase your self-esteem, self-love, as you put it, in order to be able to get past that. And when you have to go into a meeting and say, I'm John Doe and I'm an alcoholic, that doesn't exactly increase your self-esteem. but everybody says that and puts themselves down, and so you're starting off on the wrong foot. However, I will say that it helps a lot of people get from a bad addiction to a less bad addiction. Like, if a chronic alcoholic comes in and they're able to stop drinking, but they have to be addicted to the meeting, well, the meeting is not going to kill them, but the drinking will. So it's a good program. The 12 steps are great things that would be good for anybody to learn, regardless of where they find themselves on the spectrum of addiction. And I totally promote those ideas.
Yes, it's a good place to start, but it's not always the best place to finish. Exactly. You know, it's a good place to start to be abstinent from your addiction. But then if you don't understand that, if you don't deal with that underlying cause, your addiction is just going to switch over to, you know, romance or cigarettes or, you know, some other form. So you can actually be in, you know, sober from one thing for, you know, your whole life and never really get well. So it's a wonderful place to start, but it's a beginning, in my opinion, and not the end.
Yeah. So some people think, well, I drank too much. I'm going to use this program to stop drinking. Well, that works a lot, but they use that program to be romantically involved with another person in the program, to drink cigarettes and drink coffee through the entire evening. There's so many other addictive behaviors that they just substitute one for another. And I am, and I know you are, into curing the whole disease process of addiction. Well, I have a spiritual program that's 100% effective with respect to curing the disease of addiction, in my view, in my experience, if you do three things. And I want to tell you what those are and see how that lines up with what you think. The first thing is that you have to have a sincere desire to get well. And there's a lot of people that say, oh, yeah, I want to get well from my addiction, but they're not really wanting to get well because they're not willing to give up some of the things that they would have to give up or change their way of thinking in order to do it. And that will fail, both for the psychotherapist, counselor, and for the patient. So the second thing is you have to believe sincerely in your heart, not intellectually, but in your heart that you can get well. And if you don't believe that, then...
Call from Donna Mark.
Hey, Donna, you're calling me. I'm going to get rid of that. I don't know how I did that because my telephone was turned off. So, at any rate, belief is the biggest spiritual motivator to get you to the place where you can get cured. And so, if you really want to get well, and you believe you can, then you can go on to the third thing, and that's to do the program. And I have a program spelled out in the book and everything, and if you do it, everybody that I know gets well. And if they don't, I can go back and find out what of the other two things they didn't do. So what do you require of your client in order to make sure that you're a good fit, that you're not just going to be wasting your time and their money? Sorry about that. Somehow or the other, the call dropped. And as you can remember from your own personal experience, that can come at the most inopportune times. But I've gone back a little
more time. Sure.
And we're going to start back over again. I hope that I can remember exactly where we were, but I was telling you about the three things necessary to be cured from my point of view, and I think I got that on the tape. Donna, do you have any things that you require of your clients before that you will take them on as a client, because you know that if they don't do this or think this or whatever, that it's not going to be effective?
Yes, I do. First of all, I developed my own intensive program, and someone has to be willing to commit to doing the things that we will agree to, because if they don't commit, you know, to learning how to care about themselves and to love themselves and to stop poisoning their bodies and their minds, nobody can help them, and I'm no different than anybody else. So the first agreement is to, you know, make sure that you're ready to commit. You know, people get all kinds of reasons for getting help, and if they're not doing it for themselves and they're not ready, then they're not ready. And I can't make someone ready. They have to open up their heart and their mind and say, I'm tired of not sleeping at night. I'm tired of worrying about when the next bad thing's going to happen. I'm tired of DUIs. I'm tired of my family not having anything to do with me. I'm tired of having problems at work. And, you know, I'm tired of just being tired all the time. If they're not there, then they're not ready. So the first requirement is that they're really ready and that they can really commit.
Right. So that's one of my points, too. So one reason that addiction isn't detected early enough before dire consequences like death occur is that most people are in psychological denial about their symptoms in relationship to the disease. And the addict isn't the only one living in denial. Quite often, family members become enablers because they deny that the symptoms that they're seeing in their relative are relative to this disease of addiction. They try to say, well, it's not that bad, it's something else, it's whatever. So how do you have a tip on how a person can get past denial?
Are you talking about the enabler or the person with the addiction?
Either one of them or both.
Okay. Well, for the person with the addiction, you know, a person has to be willing to be honest with themselves. And usually that doesn't happen until there's a significant amount of pain. Now, I would like to inspire people to want to be well out of self-love, not pain. Because, again, you know, are you choosing because you're afraid you're going to die or go bankrupt or get a divorce? Are you choosing to get sober or to give up your addiction because you want to have a happy life, you want to have love in your life, you want to feel good about yourself, and you want to, you know, see your dreams come true why you're here on the planet? So it's two different conversations. So the denial has to come from someone being willing to ask themselves those questions. You know, if I'm doing it for someone else, I can't get there. If I'm doing it for me, then am I willing to face that this thing that I think I'm enjoying so much is actually destroying me? It's destroying my self-esteem. It's making that hole and that void grow bigger and bigger, and it's consuming me. I'm not using it anymore. It's using me. So that would be the first step of really trying to, you know, chip away at the denial that, you know, this time it's going to be different. Well, maybe I don't want to do it this time. Maybe I don't want to find out, even if it could be different. Maybe I don't want to put poison in my body anymore, toxify myself, or put myself into trauma and shock. Maybe I just want to learn how to care about myself. And then for the codependent, you know, I think codependency is just another addiction. So if I'm trying to control someone or my happiness depends on that person doing what I want them to do, then I have to look at my own denial and, again, pull back the reins, recognize that the only thing I can do for anybody, the best thing I can do for anybody, is to learn how to take care of myself. And part of that is being honest. You know, rather than tiptoeing around the addiction anymore, saying the truth without blame, without attack, but, you know, I'm really frightened for you. I don't think you've realized that you're out of control. And I believe in you, and I believe that at some point you are going to get a hold of this and do something about it. But right now, I realize I can't control it, and I'm not going to try anymore. I'm going to start enjoying my life and getting myself well. I've worked this process with many, many people. In fact, when I'm working with someone with an addiction, I would love to have the family involved. In fact, I often require that the family be involved because it gives everyone the best chance of a long-term recovery.
Yes. So you talk about self-love. I talk about low self-esteem. They're basically the same issue. And for a person to get cured from the disease of addiction, they have to build that self-esteem or self-love. And how you do that, you know, depends on who you talk to. But I'm sure that probably we have the same idea on that also.
Yeah.
But so I'm thinking that being sober, that's the term that alcoholics like to use, does not necessarily mean being well.
Correct.
So you can not do a behavior for any number of different reasons, but that didn't cure your disease of addiction. And most of the time, the person will revert to another behavior, which may be worse than, not as bad as, equal to the one that they were trying to get rid of, but they relapse into something else. And that's another thing that we have to think about when we're talking about this disease.
Yeah, that's that concept again of the one addiction. But even if someone, let's say they get sober and they eat right and they, you know, live a healthy life and they do all these things. I went through that process myself of doing all these therapy and everything imaginable to get well, and I wasn't well. That's another whole aspect that I think is very important, that you can actually get sober and work away and not get well. And that's why it's so important to really learn how to love yourself, because until you understand that you're committed to your healing and learning how to treat yourself differently, you will not be happy. So what's the point of being sober if you're not well and happy?
That's right. So going back, where does addiction start? Does it start with a hole that you need to fill? And why does abstinence fail? You said a solid self-esteem in a child is a type of personality that has no predisposition to addiction. And isn't that what we want for our children? And
correct.
What can we do as parents in order to not start them off in a hole in low self-esteem and low self-love? What is it the parent's responsibility to do or to teach the child?
Yeah, so from the time that baby's born, it's not coming into the world, like I said earlier, it's not coming into the world with a low self-esteem. And when that baby is kept warm and safe and cuddled and gotten, you know, that receives enough food and receives enough attention, they feel safe and they feel cared for. And then as they grow older to feel that they're an important part of the family, if they do something wrong, they're not abused. The parent talks to them and explains to them about choices and making good choices and versus bad choices. And they're valued for their individuality. They're encouraged to become independent. The parents recognize that they have gifts and talents, and they foster those gifts and talents, which often will develop into lifelong careers. And they just are felt approved of. They feel needed in the family. They're held accountable for their behavior, but not from a punitive perspective, but from a learning perspective. And there's a lot involved. I mean, I can't go into a whole child growth and development book here, but that child just feels a part of, feels connected, and their basic needs are met. You know, they have plenty of warmth, plenty of shelter, plenty of food, and plenty of positive attention, and they're not abused. That child feels good about themselves. So when you know, the first time someone says, here, have a cigarette, or how, you want, we're going to have a pot party tonight, you want to come, they're thinking, like, no, why would I want to do that? And this actually happened to one of my children that had never used any type of drugs or alcohol at all. This child had learned from going to meetings with me that he said, I learned I don't have to drink or drug to have an addiction, and so I don't ever want to learn how to have one. And the first time that someone said, you know, why don't you want to drink with us? I don't want to. Well, why do you want to drink? And they said, because we like the way it makes us feel. And he said, well, I like the way I feel just fine. And that's the key. You feel good about yourself. So the thought of putting something that tastes bad is going to make you feel weird. It might make you feel good weird, but nevertheless, it's not you. You know, a child that has that kind of self-esteem is protected from addiction. They're not going to want to put toxins in their body. They're not going to want to do anything that isn't good for them.
Yes. I recently co-authored a book on 25 good reasons why you would not want to drink alcohol. And as you alluded to, why do you drink it? Well, one of the reasons is, well, it loosens my inhibitions a little bit. It makes me easier to have a discussion with somebody, to fit in society. And that's not a really good reason, is it? Because you need to get to the point where you don't need something to make you feel good about your relationships with other people. And with respect to this book, if you go to my website or try to go to my email, I'll send you a free download, and you can find out 25 reasons that you can give that person that says, well, why don't you want to drink? Okay.
Perfect.
So, let's see. You are a very good writer, by the way. Did I tell you that before?
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I did get some help in, you know, making sure that the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted.
So you said that the cure of addiction is to choose love over fear, and that means taking care of yourself no matter what, no matter how
bad
yes. you feel, no matter how much discomfort you need to endure, no matter how many times you fail, you will keep on practicing loving yourself and never give up. Never.
Correct.
You said
Correct.
That there is only one cure for addiction, one way out of the maze, and that is you loving yourself. Now, that's really
yes.
great writing. And it's also,
oh, thank you.
Also the truth.
Thank you. Yes, there's no one who will ever love you more than you love yourself, and everything is a reflection of that.
Oh, Winston Churchill gave a very short, I think it was a commencement address, which I like very much, that kind of talks to this point. He got up and he said, never, 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 never give up, and sat down.
Right. Right, right. I love that.
So if you don't quit, you're never a failure.
And if you don't quit, you are succeeding.
Exactly. Now, I know that you give classes in Course in Miracles, right?
Yes. In fact, every Wednesday night at 6 o'clock, we are live on Facebook, and then we also have a Zoom meeting that anyone's welcome to join.
So how do they get there? What's the way to get there?
Well, the best way is for them to go onto my website at www.drdonnamark.com. And that's DrDonnamarks. And they'll be invited to to provide their email so that they can receive notices of meetings and workshops. And we also have a free meditation, a free self-evaluation for addiction, and we have an online course. We have a couple of online courses in addition to the comprehensive treatment program that I have established for helping people. So there's all different ways people can get help. but if they would like to join our meeting, it's free. We talk about A Course in Miracles. Sometimes I do a lecture, and then every other week we read out of the book. So it's pretty comprehensive. And then what's really nice is that people share how the course has helped them to learn how to choose love over fear.
We could talk for a long time on A Course in Miracles, and we don't have time in this show, but if you wanted to come back and discuss that topic, I would be happy to do that later. But
I would love that.
Why do you think knowing about and being involved in A Course in Miracles is so important?
Well, I think that it is a spiritual workbook and textbook, and it actually has exercises in there to help you understand how your mind is wired up in a negative, fearful way, and the exercises help you to access that you are actually truly spiritual in nature, and that there's a part of each one of us that does have a correct communion with God. And we have to learn how to access that. And it's not that loud voice of what the Course refers to as the ego that, you know, is always ranting and raving. And, you know, that voice of the ego is the voice that says, you know, you've been good. You can go ahead and have that chocolate pie, you know, just one little piece. And then by the time you're finished, the pie pan's empty. Or it'll tell you, you know, you haven't had a drink in a year, for God's sake. You can surely just drink normal now. You know, that voice is the voice of the ego, but that's the same exact voice that will beat you up as soon as you do it. As soon as those consequences set in and you have that horrible, failed, awful feeling, like, why did I do this? That ego is going to be the voice that says, well, why did you do that, you stupid idiot? And no one's realizing that, wait a minute, you just told me to do it. Now you're telling me I'm stupid? So once we understand how the ego works and we learn to go to that place, that spiritual place within us, I don't care what you call it. I like to call it love. There's a place where love resides in each one of us, and learn how to access that, including forgiving ourselves for mistakes and trying and never giving up, but learning how to access that voice that will say, do you really want to do this? Do you really want to eat that? Do you really want to drink that? You really want to smoke that? You really want to get on that site on the internet? Is that really going to make you feel better about yourself tomorrow? Once you learn how to access that voice and you choose love instead of that ranting, ego, fear-based voice, you won't have to suffer the guilt and the shame and the anger anymore. You will attain a sense of peace and joy that you won't allow anything to rob you of. And the Course leads us in that direction through the textbook and the exercises.
Okay. Now, I told you you were a good writer, and I'm going to read something that you wrote. You said that underneath every addiction is the desire to replace an unwanted feeling with a better one. The problem is, it doesn't work. We reach for something, and sure enough, we get momentarily relieved, but it quickly fades into remorse. When the addiction stops, the good feelings of being alive can return. Until your brain is rerouted with love, you will continue to unconsciously fear the feelings that will come up when you make the choice for abstinence. You think that if you don't do this, you will feel worse than you do now, and that's the underlying thought that precedes using. The thought of deprivation or loss is what will propel you to keep doing the very thing that creates more suffering and more loss, right?
And, correct.
And then following that, you talked about three steps toward having more self-love. Can you tell us quickly what those three steps are?
I think that the three steps that I'm referring to is to, you know, understand that this is that one addiction and being willing to face that and say, I really want to get well. I'm not willing to torture myself anymore. And then I'm willing to have, you know, to get the courage up to choose love over fear and space what is causing me to keep doing this over and over and over again, that underlying pain and that low self-esteem, and what caused that low self-esteem. And then to make a commitment to just loving myself, which means, you know, the from the time I wake up in the morning to the time I go to sleep at night, then I'm making choices that enhance my self-esteem, and that I'm not only thinking about myself, but I'm connecting with other people as well. I'm sharing, you know, rather, addiction is about getting. What can I get today? How can I get this? How can I get that? We don't realize it's get all day long, rather than how can I share all day long. And when we shift over from getting to sharing, we are then in a place of love. And the more we do that, the more we recognize we have so much to give. So that sense of worthlessness goes into that sense of purpose and meaning. And after a while that someone has really not engaged in an addiction anymore, they're enjoying their life so much because there's balance, there's love, there's relationships, there's whether they have a career or they're doing some type of philanthropic work, they're loving it and enjoying it, and their life is rich and full and has meaning, and they know that they're fulfilling their purpose. And that's the ultimate. You know, that's why we're here. We're here to share and receive love. This is a beautiful playground, and even though some people insist upon making it into, you know, anything but that at times, or they have no respect for the beauty of our planet, we are here to love, to share, to connect, to play, to have fun, but it's about love. And, you know, so once we really fully recover, our world looks like that. Our world is about sharing and receiving that love and having meaning and purpose and enjoying life to its fullest.
One of the biggest concepts in my treatment program is that everyone was created for purpose.
Yeah.
Most people don't know that. And even if they thought, well, yeah, that's true, they say, I don't know what my purpose is. But
right.
If you can find what you believe your purpose is and follow it, the addiction will drop out of sight because you'll be too busy helping other people in some way or the other to be concerned
right.
about your selfishness of your own, I want this, I want that.
Yes. Yes, exactly. When I'm working with someone, we get to the point that they actually forget they have an addiction because they're so busy enjoying their life and they're doing the things that I just described. And it doesn't even cross their mind anymore about doing something that isn't good for them because they're too busy having a good time and feeling good and a whole new meaning. You know, when I was addicted, I would drive down. I live in one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I would drive down, and everything seemed black and white because I was so into myself and into that void inside and into that whole invisible consumption of, you know, nothingness. And when I shifted into this place of love, I started noticing, like, gosh, this is so beautiful. There's green, beautiful trees everywhere. There's a waterway, and there's, like, it looks like diamonds are sparkling on the surface, and, you know, I have a nice car, and look, I'm healthy, and, you know, I have so much to be grateful for. My kids are healthy, and I love them, and they love me, and, you know, it just went on and on and on and on, and I just got this overwhelming sense of gratitude for things that meant nothing to me, nothing. And once we have those kinds of shifts in perception, it's a beautiful thing, and then we don't think about getting addicted anymore because we're too busy making plans to do fun and exciting things, whether it's work or personal. It's just not in our mind to be thinking about the addiction. I forgot I had addiction. I'm enjoying my life so much.
Well, I'm going to use what you said to go back to this point. You said no amount of suffering will stop addiction. The only time a person ever stops is when they decide that enough is enough. This means the person has decided to care enough about themselves to use the get out of hell free card. And that card
right.
is called love. And you know,
right. Yeah.
Great way to put it.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Yes. That's really, that's what I was, you know, trying to really convey in my message to people. Like, don't, you don't have to wait until so many bad things happen that you're in jail or someone's court ordered you to treatment. That's never a good reason to get sober. Get sober because you've decided that you want your life back. Realize that your addiction has hijacked your mind. It has convinced you that you need it, and then it beats up on you for needing it. So once you realize that, then you can be inspired to say, you know, maybe I could just, maybe just for one day, just try it for one day. Like, if I really cared about myself and if I did have a good self-esteem and if I loved myself, how would I act today? You know, would I get up and start griping about all the bad things, or would I maybe notice that, you know, I'm in a safe place, or that there's a beautiful sunshine coming up, or, you know, hear the sound of the birds, or maybe I could just be grateful for some little thing that I have, and I could nourish my body with healthy foods and maybe do some exercise, and maybe I'll call some people and see how they're doing rather than waiting for my phone to ring and me, and just try that for one day and see what happens. I think you'll find that a miracle will happen in that one day. It will take hold. That little spark of self-love and caring for yourself and others will take hold. And, you know, it's just like you can be in a pitch-black room and you turn on that light switch. It doesn't take 100 light bulbs to light up the room. It only takes one. So it only takes one moment of a person's willingness to open up that light within them and get rid of all this behavior that is so dark and so destructive and replace it with love. That inspiration is what will get a person truly well, not just sober, but truly happy and healed and whole. Because that's the way we're born. We're not creating a miracle here. We're just restoring ourselves to our true state, the way we were born, the way we were meant to be.
I'm going to use your own personal experience and what you wrote to drive home a point. You said, "No addiction I ever had ended with the pain and suffering. They all ended when I decided to care about myself, and I realized no one would or could care about me more than I. That reality allowed me to use my mind for a higher purpose rather than destroying my body and self-esteem with toxic substances, relationships, and otherwise bad choices. Once I realized that I was not on the planet to self-destruct, I was able to listen to that voice inside me that had always said, 'You can do better than this.' I held on to that voice when my addiction tried to get me to numb my feelings. I held on to that voice when my shameful past was waved in my face. I held on to that voice when someone hurt me and I didn't want to forgive. I held on to that voice no matter what. The most important message that voice ever told me was, 'You are here for a reason.' And that's when my purpose changed from serving my addiction to serving that higher purpose. My only purpose is to share and receive love. Everything else follows. Nothing else matters." Did I kind of get to the core of it from what you...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, you certainly did.
So, how is it possible, you wrote, that despite failing health, severe hangovers, complete loss of time, a person will drink again? How can someone who has lost all of their possessions from gambling briefly stop and then go right back to the casino? How do couples who can't stop hurting each other and repeatedly break up continue to reconcile? How does someone suffering from diabetes, obesity, ill health continue to eat unhealthy foods that are burying them alive? How does someone who has been warned of COPD continue to light up a cigarette? How does someone who overdoses on drugs risk dying the next time? how many consequences does it take to crack a person's denial? Man, that's powerful. But that's what we see around us all the time.
Yeah.
People deny. And I guess it's because their ego won't allow them to face their own personal truth.
That's the disease, yes, the ego. And I think it's the same thing. I think the ego just, you know, uses a disease to claim our lives. But yes, that's what it does. It keeps us lying to ourselves all the time. And it's very sad. But, you know, the good news is we don't have to listen to it. We have a choice. We can either listen to it and do all those things that we just outlined, which are all deadly, and ultimately we will die. We won't die from coronavirus. We will die from the compromised immune systems that we have, and that in most cases are caused by addiction. Someone has either used alcohol, nicotine, smoking, drugs, high sugar content foods, high trans fat foods, and they've used those things. And I mean use them, not enjoy them. They've used those things to the point that they've caused permanent damage to their body so that their immune system is compromised and their health is compromised. And when they get a bad virus, it kills them. It could be, you know, most of these people that die of the flu aren't dying of the flu. They're dying of heart disease that hasn't been diagnosed, or kidney failure, or lung problems, and liver problems, because they have unknowingly been addicted. And so once we realize to the only solution here is treat your body like it were a little baby, you know, you wouldn't give a baby a cigarette. If they were crying and unhappy, you wouldn't give them a shot of whiskey or a joint. I mean, that's just ridiculous. You wouldn't start shoving chocolate pie in their mouth or ice cream. You know, you would hug them, comfort them, and figure out what their real needs were. And so that's what we have to do for ourselves. Treat our bodies and our minds just as if we're a newborn baby and it needs the right kind of love and care.
I want to go back and tell the audience another thought from you personally until they get to the point of actually being able to buy the book. And we haven't gone through the entire book because there's too much good stuff in there for us to do in this limited period of time. But these are some things that you wrote, and if the person listening today connects with them, there's only one thing that they can do that's smart, and that's get the book, Exit the Maze. And you said, there is no amount of pain or negative consequences that can stop a person from addiction. The only thing that will halt the behavior is for a purpose to realize that the addict is not who they are. It's not the romantic, edgy, exciting journey into altered states and fantasies. It's a living nightmare that blindly leads the addicted into hell. The admission price to hell is a few moments of bliss, followed with ever-ending remorse, anxiety, and suffering. This pattern does not stop the addict. It only pulls the person deeper into the maze of shame and intensifies the need for more, more, more. How brilliant that was.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, those of us that have been to hell and back understand how it works.
Yeah.
And we don't want to see anybody else have to needlessly suffer. But it's not just about that. We want to see people know who they are. And, you know, when I'm working with someone, they'll say, I lost myself. I want to get back to who I am. And I'll say, who are you? Who is that person? And sometimes they have to struggle. I was talking to a woman the other day. She says, well, I'm energetic and I'm happy and I'm on fire for life. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. That's who you are. Not someone who's trying to get high all the time or is constantly needing to be distracted with the next quick fix. Who you are is a vibrant, alive person who's here to enjoy your life and to help other people. That's why we're all here.
Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to Donna Marks today for, I guess we've gone over an hour, but, you know, it's all very important stuff that you should take to heart. Listen to this program again and again, because you never get everything out of it the first time. And tell your friends and relatives to go to the podcast to hear what Donna has to say, because it is brilliant. It is highly necessary for everybody to understand what she's talking about and then connect with her, either through her book or through her website or through her Zoom meetings or however you can. Because
yes, and when we're on a movement, you know, we're trying to start a movement here of people, you know, not using addiction anymore for a false sense of happiness. You know, we're on a movement to save lives and to help people to, you know, recover and ideally at some point in time, once we understand what causes that void, you know, to prevent it altogether. So yes, the more people that hear your show, and I know you've had some amazing guests on there. It's so exciting. And your life work, you know, I'm sure you're very gratified and it's very rewarding. And especially to switch from medicine now to, you know, to this, it's wonderful. And, you know, to be a part of that movement, the planet is in such need of healing. You know, this is the global crisis. It's addiction. And we've been lured into this maze, you know, or in denial and because of the desire, you know, for the next thing, the next quick fix. And to be able to arrest that, you know, and bring people back to who they are is the greatest gift in the world and the most exciting adventure.
Absolutely. Well, Donna, unless there's something else that I forgot to ask you, which I know there is, but that you want to tell the people right now, we're going to end this discussion, and hopefully you can come back and then we can have another one later.
Oh, I would love that, and I just want to encourage anybody to, you know, go onto my website and connect, and, you know, send emails or sign up for the list to get, do a blog. Every day I write something or have a video, and would love to, you know, have you be a part of this movement, and whatever we can do to support you, we're here for you.
Thank you. And for the audience that found this extremely interesting and important like I did, let me give you a link to the podcast where you can go directly to Donna to hear it again or give it to your relatives or friends, and that's www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. Spell Libsyn, Libsyn, and that will take you directly to the podcast. So have a wonderful day, Donna, and everybody that's listening today, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. It was a pleasure.